A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 16, 2003, entitled The Source of Authority, in the series Religion and the Human Story. The text for the sermon is from Mark 11, verses 15 through 19 and 27 through 33. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Well, I began my Saturday morning, as usual, with my devotions with the Grand Rapids Press Religion Section. Once in a while, there's something stimulating that gets me started, and most of the time it provokes me into energized sermon writing. But I was caught, my attention was caught by Charlie Honey, who had read a New York Times article from the cosmologist that the satellite somewhere beyond the moon that has been orbiting the Earth now for some time has mapped the universe such that the information is remarkable. And while I don't understand the remarkable information that they've gotten, something about all matter, etc., being 4% of the universe, and then there's some dark matter, 20-some percent, and 70-some percent dark energy, which nobody yet knows what it is. But Charlie Honey, in reading this, apparently said that his mind was blown, and he wondered if anyone else freaked out by this news that the universe is expanding, inflating at ever rapidening speed, and that in a few billion years, give or take, there'll be nothing but this thing blowing apart, a huge ice crystal, I guess, or something like that, not very inviting, a little bit like this morning, I think. Charlie Honey, I realize you have to come up with a sermon every week, you have to come up with a column every week, and so you have to figure out something to say. It'd be provocative or interesting, but he began to ask questions of what does this mean if this whole thing is going to not come down and do a cinder, a big crunch, but it's going to be a big blast off. What does that mean for eternal life? What does that mean for the new heaven and the new earth? What does that mean for the Hindu for reincarnation or reunion with the Godhead and so forth? Those kinds of questions. And as I was contemplating that, to my rescue came our resident cosmologist, Howard Ventil, who faxed me the article from the Times itself. Very interesting. Not that I understood any better exactly what the breakthrough in understanding was, but I was thinking about my sermon this morning, the source of authority, as we continue to think about religion and the human story. And as I paused to read the article, what struck me was the contrast between the religious community in which I operate and the scientific community in which Howard operates, and physicists and astronomers and the like. Because in this article, what was celebrated was the fact that many theories were put to rest. There was a culling out of theories about the inflation of the cosmos. And there was a rejoicing in the fact now that they had better information, that they could put away some of that provisional and tentative suggestion of an earlier day. And they rejoiced in the fact that they had something now to work on for the next 5 years. And one of the Stanford astronomers said that while this new data put to death one of his pet theories, which was quote-unquote painful, and nonetheless, he rejoiced in the fact that some of his other suppositions were confirmed. Well, this isn't about cosmology, but it is about two different communities And I was so struck with the fact, thinking about the source of authority in the religious community, how different is the scientific community. Where there is work with hard data, where there is an empirical method, where there are facts that can be verified, where one can set forth a model or a paradigm and test it, and then discard it or create a larger paradigm that includes it and incorporates it. But always the fun of science, I sense, is that you're constantly trying to disprove your pet theory in order to find a better one. And that just ain't so in religion. Because what has marked the religious community is an external authority imposed upon it. And as I contemplated the contrast, I came to a new appreciation again of the source of authority in the religious life, which for me has taken, well, just a 180-degree turn from where I began. When I was in Florida on vacation this year, the major study in which I engaged was a volume by Gary Dorian, who is distinguished professor of religion at Kalamazoo College and perhaps one of the finest writers of the history of theology working today. Gary Dorian was here in October when David Ray Griffin was here, that outstanding scholar that none of you could understand, remember? Well, Gary Dorian brought volume one of a three-volume project and gave it to me, the Making of American Liberal Theology. And it was a marvelous experience to read the 19th century development of liberal theology in this country. As I read it, I thought I never read it before, never studied it before. Someone said, oh yeah, there was a course taught, but if there was a course taught, I wasn't listening, shame on me. And if there was a course taught where I went, it was taught in terms of what was wrong with American liberal theology. And as you all know, I come from the far right end. I was just off the right end of the spectrum of theological opinion from conservative to liberal. And so I never took it very seriously. And what I missed was an absolutely marvelous development in this country of theological understanding from in the New England states particularly, a very solid, heavy Calvinism to an American liberal theology marked on the one hand by Unitarianism and by the whole development within the Congregational Church and so forth. And as I read that, I was so struck with the fact that I, in my own person, have replicated the 19th century in my own experience. If someone had told me about that earlier, number one, I wouldn't have listened. But number two, it could have saved me a lot of grief. Because if it's all been gone through before, why did I have to go through it myself and drag you through it, kicking and screaming as well? But as I read Gary Dorian, it resonated with me because I had discovered down in the depths of my own being that the issue finally comes to a matter of authority. For your Sunday afternoon pleasure, I included an excerpt in your liturgy, which I'm not going to read for you, except to say that Dorian writes, in essence, it is the idea, liberal theology, is the idea that Christian theology can be genuinely Christian without being based upon external authority. And then in that same first page around the middle, he says, before the modern period, all Christian theologies were constructed within a house of authority. All pre-modern Christian theologies made claims to an authority-based orthodoxy. And he goes on to indicate that in the Reformed Lutheran traditions, it was the authority of the infallible, the inerrant Word of God. And the scriptures were elevated in the 16th century, particularly in the 17th century, as the Reformation fires began to dampen and the scholastic movement moved in. The scriptures were elevated because the Protestant movement that was young and fledgling and insecure needed something in which to stand over against the awesome power and authority of the Roman Catholic Church. And as Dorian says in this little excerpt, the Roman Catholic Church continued with the tradition and the Bible, and then now made infallible the teaching office of the church or papal authority. And as for Eastern Orthodoxy, that ancient Eastern rite, they have had an ecclesiastical tradition and liturgy that has been absolutized for centuries. So that in the case of the whole Christian church, pre-modern, Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Protestant, in all of its varieties, they have lived in a house of authority, an externally imposed authority, either the institution or the book or the tradition, but always living within that authority imposed upon it from the outside. And as I thought about all of that, I recognized in the development of American liberal theology that Dorian was right, that the issue was the refusal of an externally imposed authority. So that's what I want to think with you, or have you think with me about this morning for a few moments. As I ask you, what is the source of your authority? I laughed at myself. That's such an exciting title. Wouldn't everybody want to come to church just to hear what one would have to say about the source of authority? What a boring title. But I want you to know the sermon's better than the title. And the subject is more important than the sermon could possibly indicate, because we're talking about something very practical this morning. What is the source of your authority? Well, let's talk about ourselves together as a community for a moment. What's the source of our authority? We call ourselves an independent liberal congregation. Independent. That means we're non-affiliated. That means we have no pope or bishop or diocesan bishop or supervisor or denominational office or presbytery to which we are accountable. Yes! Scratch that. Lack of accountability can be a problem, particularly if you get some charismatic heretic, he can take you on the road to perdition. But for just a little while, let's enjoy it, this freedom. But we're liberal. And what is liberal? And I raise a question with some fear and trepidation, fearing that my father is listening. Because liberal was always a dirty word for me. You have to know, still for me, to consider myself a liberal is to feel that I'm somewhat betraying something. But here I stand, I can do no other, to quote another radical of years gone by. A liberal is not a position. It's a posture and a process. There was a liberal theology, and you could describe a liberal theology, but to the extent that you can describe a liberal theology, it has already gone to seed. Because to be a liberal is to have a certain posture and to be in a process of open inquiry, critical reflection, and understanding the provisionalness and the tentativeness of all of our conclusions. It is the refusal of an externally imposed authority. It is the determination to continue to keep one's mind and heart open to the ongoing human journey, story, call it what you will. Such a posture is over against that which comes to it from outside. It is an authority that must rise up within. So you say, well, are we out there hanging then? Are we all alone? Do we start out with a blank slate? Do we reinvent the wheel with every generation? No, of course not. We have a story. We have a text. We have a text that we revere and we respect and we mine and we value highly. It's our founding story. It's a story of Israel and its Exodus experience and its long history with its awesome sense of God, its prophetic witness, its hope. And out of the womb of Israel has come Jesus, the Jew. And from Jesus, the community that gathered round now, 2,000 years old, we have a story. We have a book. It's an ancient text. But it tells us that revelatory luminosity that was the catalyst for this community which has eventuated in the likes of us. And then we have in our Jewish Christian story a tradition now 4,000 years old, Christian story 2,000 years old. And that story, that's been a living tradition. And that's been the ongoing human experience in the light of the story. And there are glorious moments of creedal affirmation. There are heroic moments of great sacrifice and great virtue. And there are dark moments. Inquisitions and crusades and holocausts. But it's a tradition. It flows out of the story and it has shaped us. It has made us who we are. It is the lens through which we understand ourselves and our life and our history. And then, and now I'm coming to the particular characteristic of the liberal tradition. We have not only the story, the tradition, but we have critical thinking, our own reason and our minds, by which we reflect on the story and we understand the tradition. And fourth, concrete human experience. We have concrete human experience. If you have an external authority imposed upon you, for example, the Protestant infallible and errant Bible as the Word of God, then it's like you have a template and you put the template down on the human experience, and human experience can only be according to that ancient text, when human experience will squish out all over the place because the story didn't stop 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. Concrete human experience is one of the elements that we factor in. We read the story, we understand the tradition. We have experience and we think. So we're not out there hanging alone. We don't start with a blank slate. We're a shaped people, a traditioned people, but we're a thinking people, and we have this marvelous historical consciousness and knowledge and understanding of whence we have come and all of that. We put all that together, and then in the concrete moment, we decide. We decide who we are and how then we should live. That, I think, is a fair description of what it means to be liberal in the religious quest. The source of authority finally rises from within. Jesus was asked, "What is your authority?" Now, Jesus was shaped by the book, nurtured in the tradition, but he called his tradition to account, because as he lived out of the story and in the tradition, in the concrete experience of his day, he could see that his religious institution and religion, as every spiritual, every human historical movement, will always become institutionalized. He could see that his institutionalized story and tradition had failed to be that liberating movement full of grace. It had become a domination system. And so his prophetic act at the temple, we call it the cleansing of the temple, was his protest. You could make the argument that Jesus was the first Protestant. He protested the domination system of the temple priesthood, which was religion, state, and church all combined. And he protested against it because there was that within him that rose up within him. And the people, there's another place in the gospel where it says the people heard him gladly, because he taught as one who had authority and not as the scribes and Pharisees. Well, of course, this is prejudiced New Testament accounting. But there was, as a matter of fact, obviously there must have been this note of authenticity, this note of integrity, so that when he spoke, there was a resonance in the being of the other. And the gospel writers tell us the common people heard him gladly because there was that note of authenticity or authority. Interestingly, it was the temple authorities who had authority. We say authorities, the temple authorities. What they had was power. They were in the position of power. Institutions finally become institutionalized and become power plays. Those who are the guardians of the tradition become the lords of the tradition. And if you are in charge, if you are the guardian, if you have reached a place where to be in the institution is to have a vested interest, then what you really want is solidity. You really want peace and serenity. You really want stability. You don't want some prophet suggesting that there is rot at the core. But the people, they were astounded. And the authorities said, "What are we going to do?" Isn't it interesting? I don't care if you're talking about national government or any form of government or the church, when you finally get into the position of power, you don't say, "Is that true?" You say, "What will we do in order to keep the lid on?" Because what happens in institutionalization is that power is given, delegated to the authority. But when the authority has lost heart and soul, there's only power, no longer authority. I think that may be what's going on in our world today, where we have the power. We can, and I suspect we will, do what we will. But without the authority that resonates in the broad spectrum of the human heart. So, what is the source of your authority? Can't be the preacher. Obviously, there's no diocesan rule. The Bible is valued, but not absolutized. The tradition is helpful, but it's not an authoritarian tradition that binds us. Where is your authority? What inspires you? What moves you? What gives you hope? What is it that causes you to say, "Yes"? Where is your heart? What is your deepest intuition? What is your finest insight? Trust it. Follow it. And then, in a community like this, we can talk about it. And we recognize that there will be a diversity of understanding. And there will be the interchange of various points of view. And we'll all know, as we accord respect to one another, that the end of it all is not to have everybody sign on the dotted line to dot the I and cross the T, but to be honest, authentic, to speak with a voice of integrity. And when we speak thus, the world will listen. And we will be honest to God.